I've known Katie a really long time. I say that I know her super well. We live in not the same area of town, so we don't really see each other at meetings, but I can tell you we see each other at tons of service and AA functions, much like where we are tonight, general service, other conventions. And I was thinking about the first time I saw her, I thought, and this is like a really long time ago, I thought, look at her. I thought she's tall and blonde and young and everybody likes her. I said, you know, my drinking days, you would have had a target on your forehead. You know, and today I'm like, how lucky am I? She is just so cool and you know, so admired by many. And I know it's because she works a great program and she's very involved in service work, which is something we share in common. And I had to laugh when I was thinking somebody brought up Kleenex to her before this. And I thought, where were they at dinner? You know, we aren't that close, but we had dinner and we just hit a moment. We were both in tears, you know, and I'm like, where else but like your Alcoholics Anonymous friends can you do something like that? And it was like, it was okay. We moved right along, but it was just like, we can do that and it's okay, you know, to be able to share your feelings and at that intimate of a level to somebody who isn't necessarily your BFF. So it was just great getting to know her a little better tonight too. So without anything further, I'd like to introduce you to Katie M.
Hi, I'm Katie. I'm an alcoholic. And this is really squeaky and awkward back here. So, okay, well, first of all, it's really cool to be here at the Marietta Roundup, because I have been to a few before, and I spent a little bit of time on the Marietta Roundup committee years ago, and I've been a raffle girl, so thank you for your service. you know, and it's always a lot of fun and really special, and what's really been neat tonight is I've seen a lot of people tonight that I haven't seen in a while, and I love that about... Okay, I love that about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I also very specifically love that about being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it takes me outside of the world of my little home group, and I get to meet some awesome, amazing people, and I get to meet all of the people who are really interested in being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I think are the coolest people. And I'll tell you this one story really quick, and then I'll get into my own story really in a minute. But I was at Assembly once, our state, our area assembly. So I was down in Macon at the area assembly, and there was a couple of people who had just come down for their first time as GSR. And, you know, it was... They were like just kind of taking it all in, and you know, and to me, Macon, if you've never been to the area assembly, it overwhelmed the heck out of me the first time I ever went. I was like, oh my gosh, there's like a whole new slew of acronyms here, and this treasurer's report, and like what is going on? Like it hurt my head. Like it was just a lot to take in. Literally, my head hurt by the time I left. So you know, with new GSRs for their first time, I'm like, yeah, you know. So you know, we're having lunch afterwards, and after you know, on Sunday after the whole thing, and I was like, so what did you think? And this chick just lit up. She was like, it was like AA concentrate. She's like, it is like all the people who clean up after the meeting, but all in one place at the same time, like all of those people. And I was like, that is the coolest thing I have ever heard said about the assembly. So while it's business and there's like a lot of AA things that I didn't understand that are going on, you know, it's a lot to take in. But it is so cool because of the kind of people that show up and are willing to do that kind of service. Like, those are my people. Those are the kind of people that I love to be around. And so those are the kind of people that I ran into tonight, people I hadn't seen since I'd been in an assembly, and I haven't been at a few. And so it's really cool to see some familiar faces. So thank you to the committee for bringing me here tonight. And I guess I'll start by doing the rudimentary qualifications. And that is, you know, I do have a home group. My home group is Rule 62, which is at the 8111 Club. And it is, of course, the most awesome home group in all of Atlanta. I'm sure you guys have some cool things going on over here in Marietta, but, you know, Rule 62 is definitely the best home group in the world. You can come and hang out with us on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays at 8 p.m. And that I do have a sponsor, and my sobriety date is May the 15th of 1989, and we'll get to how that happened, because it still hurts my head that thinking about how long I've been around just hurts my head because it wasn't my plan when I got here. So, let's start at the very beginning, which is that I was born in New York. I was born in New York City. And my parents divorced when I was young, and my dad moved down here. So probably about the time I was five, my dad moved down here when I was about six or seven and had remarried. And I spent most of my childhood split between those two places. So anybody that knows me very well knows that I have a very confused accent, which can sometimes sound very Yankee and very sassy and very often can sound very Southern, because now I've just lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else. So I split a lot of time back and forth. It's so funny. I think about certain aspects of my childhood, like the fact that I went to 9 different schools in 12 years, and that sounds really tragic, like, man, I went to 9 different schools in 12 years. But, I mean, I was not a great kid, and I was always an awkward kid from the beginning. I'm one of those people, I believe I was an alcoholic probably long before I ever picked up a drink, and that alcohol absolutely fixed something in me that already felt very broken. So I switched schools around, and I'd go be with one parent over here and go to this school, then I'd have to move and go to this school. I mean, that was just kind of how it was. And then the last few school moves, honestly, were due to me, and my behavior. So while it sounds very uprooted, most of the time I was ready to leave a school. Most of the time I had already created enough awkward situations and had enough awkward friendships that if I had to go to another school, it was like, oh, thank goodness I can start over. You know, so every time I went to a new school, I felt like, all right, now we're going to get this right. And, you know, before long, my life was, and this was before drinking. I mean, this was just me being an awkward kid, you know, saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. I mean, that was just, you know, how my childhood was. All right, I'll tell this one story because it kind of sums up the kind of child I was. And, you know, it's a cute story, but you know, fourth grade, and I'm living in Clayton County, Georgia, which is where my dad lived at the time, and I'm going to elementary school. And in elementary school, you know, you do cute little awkward things. Our teacher was showing us something called the elephant walk. And the elephant walk was where she bent over and was swinging her arms like an elephant and walking around the circle. And when she went by, I just reached out and smacked her on the butt. I didn't, like, think this is going to be funny. I really didn't think about it. I just kind of did it. And then she turned around, and it was an awkward moment, like, where all the kids just kind of, it wasn't funny. It was just like, what? And then I think she kind of finally pulled it together enough to kind of pull me outside of the classroom and go, like, you just don't do that. Like, that's just weird. And so just know that my childhood is peppered with just a lot of really awkward moments like that. And then that'll give you a good enough picture. So by the time I was in middle school or junior high school, I was living back in New York City, and I was going to school on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I had previously gone to a private school in Brooklyn for a couple of years. And the private school I went to in Brooklyn was this really nice private school that was very hip, and the kids there were really smart. And we talked about a lot of things like, what kind of college are we going to go to, you know, Harvard or Yale, you know, maybe Stanford, Rogue, you know, like which one was really the best school, you know, because we were all going to be these like great professional people and we all had, you know, this great track. And so I went from this school to moving back to Manhattan. The oil stocks had dropped and we had to move back to our co-op in Manhattan, which sounds really sheeshy, but I mean, where we lived wasn't that cool. It was an area called Morningside Heights between Columbia University and Harlem. And I had to go to a public school, and in this public school, I walk in, and I'm like, I'm the only white girl in the entire school. There was a couple white dudes, but it was a mishmash. I mean, it's New York City, so, I mean, it's everything, you know, so Puerto Ricans and Asians and blacks, Hispanics, everything else. So it was awkward for me just kind of walking in, and it was a little bit of a tough school, and I kind of did what I thought was like a normal way to handle that situation, which was, I mean, I basically, like, kind of ended up jumping in with some Puerto Ricans and speaking half Spanish and half English and sounding like a Puerto Rican. So that was what I thought was a normal way to approach that kind of a situation. And so what made it really interesting was then I would go hang out in Brooklyn Heights sometimes with my friends from the private school on the weekends. So I would go from, like, this kind of during the week pretending to be the sort of tough girl speaking Spanglish and then, you know, go right back to dressing a different way and hanging out with my friends in Brooklyn on the weekends. And there was a point where there was going to be an event that was going to happen. And this event that was going to happen was going to involve one of my good friends from the private school and one of my good friends from the public school being in the same place at the same time. Now, this event never actually happened. I don't remember what it was. But what I do remember is my absolute gut-wrenching terror at having no idea how I was going to act or who I was going to be when that situation happened. So just be in that place with me. And then picture you're this really tall, lanky girl with no boobs and bad hair and braces. And right about this time was when I had my first drink. And if you ask me, it was like not a moment too soon. My first drink was on New Year's Eve when I was 12 years old. And it was not super duper dramatic. We were at home in Manhattan, and my grandparents were over. And, you know, we just had our own little family New Year's Eve celebration. And I had had sips of alcohol before, like I'd had a sip of wine, a sip of something else, and I never got past the, like taking that sip and going like, ugh, that's nasty. But this night they let me have champagne, and I had a little flute glass of champagne, and I was like, well, this is not so bad. So before anybody had really noticed, I knocked down like four tall flute glasses of champagne. And, you know, it wasn't earth-shatteringly dramatic, but it was enough. The things that I remember about that night was I was a little tipsy, and I remember walking around, and my grandparents were like, oh, look, she's a little tipsy, she's drunk. I liked it very much. And what I remember is I went back to the champagne bottles because I wanted more, and that was it. Like, I had finished off the champagne, that was it. My parents, my immediate parents, were clearly not alcoholics because they were. That was an inadequate amount of champagne for a New Year's Eve. But what happened was once I really started drinking, I wanted to keep drinking. I knew that there was further to go. So that's what I remember about that very first drink. And that was the significant difference between me and, I think, a normal drinker. So from that point, if I had an opportunity to drink, I could get past the nasty taste because now I knew where I was going with it. And so when I had opportunities to drink, I did. And it's not like at that point I started to, like, drink every day. You know, I didn't drink every day. I was 12. But everything that was a priority in my life changed. And that was totally the time when I started skipping school. And I could skip school in junior high school in New York. It wasn't that hard because they had a lot of problems at my school. And so one little kid missing from class, really not that big of an issue. So I started skipping school, and I found my people, you know, and it was I had arrived, you know. I remember, you know, being around some folks once, and like, and I had, you know, and I'd smoked weed for the first time, and, you know, this one kid's like, what? You got the white girl high, man? Like, right on, you know? And it was like, that was I was in, you know? And it was like people who I never really hung out with in class before, you know, who I didn't even know, like, I was in. That's what I remember about that period of time, and that nothing else was important. So right when I was starting to take a real steep, sharp tumble in my grades, everything, you know, already going to hell in a handbasket, my mom decides that we're going to move from Manhattan to Granville, Ohio, for me to start high school. So I moved to Granville, Ohio. And now Granville, Ohio's one saving grace is that there's a university there called Denison University, a small liberal arts college that was once described in the Barron's Book of Colleges as the best academic party school in America. I don't think that they're like that anymore, but at the time that I went, this is kind of what it was like. All the kids who partied just a little too much to get into the really good Northeastern schools, they went to Denison. And so what I learned to do was sneak out of my house and... this started a time with my mom where I had already gotten into some trouble in New York, and, you know, we started the consequence that she tried to control, you know, that she tried to wrangle herself around what I was doing. So I started seeing a therapist named Suzanne. I was grounded all the time. I was, you know, we had contracts, we had talks, we had all of these things, and none of it meant, I mean, you know, all of it was fruitless. Anybody who's been through that with a teenager, or maybe you were the teenager, I'm not really sure, you know how well all that goes, you know. And so what happened the next few years, my drinking continued and got worse and escalated. And the things I cared about became less and less. And finally drove my mom to a place, because where she basically said, you need to either leave, as in get out, or you need to go live with your dad, who said that he would take you in Atlanta. And this was after a night where I had snuck out. I had gone to the college campus. You know, I had come home, and then I snuck back out again. And my mom woke up and didn't know where I was. And where I was passed out on a dorm floor. Because the kind of drinker that I was, I didn't drink every day. But every time I drank until I blacked out. Unless you told me to go home or we ran out of alcohol. Which, teenagers, sometimes that happened. But if those two things didn't happen, I drank to blackout every single time from the beginning. And so I had passed out in somebody's dorm, and, you know, my mom had put out, she was a professor at the university, she put out an APB just in general looking for me. And so there was an RA going down the halls going, if anybody knows where Katie Thornberry is, tell her her mom is looking for her and she needs to go home now. So these guys were like, you need to go, because I was a 16-year-old passed out on their floor. And I walked home, and I had a great story that I was going to tell my mom, and she was just like, look, you know, the two choices. You can either go live independently, which means get out, or you can go live with your dad. And I was like, I guess I'll go live with dad. I didn't know anybody at the time who lived independently. And I was like, I'll go hang out with dad. That's great. So I moved back down here to Atlanta. And at this time, my dad was twice divorced, single, and guilt-ridden. And I didn't realize how advantageous that situation would be until I got here. And you know, we had that talk as soon as I got here. We're not going to have any of that kind of funny business, you know, like you had at your mom's. Oh, no, of course not, Dad. And then within a week, I had done basically the same thing. I had gone out, you know, drank too much, blacked out. I was supposed to be home. I wasn't home. Came home. Or actually, Dad had to come pick me up, and I didn't even know where I was. And he had to come and get me. You know, I tried to lie. It didn't work. And then he grounded me. He grounded me for a week. All right. And then he let me out after 5 days because I was making him miserable around the house. So I learned that with my dad, I could get away with anything, you know. And that was, there's a big turn that happened in Atlanta, and that was like I really stopped caring whether or not I got kicked out. Because, you know, by this time, my hair is like all black. It's shaved around the sides. I love my people who live in little Five Points, like 10 people in one apartment, like crammed in. So I almost want to get kicked out because then I can go do that. And that looks awesome to me. That, I mean, it really did. I wanted to get kicked out so that I could go live in an apartment with 10 people in little Five Points. And by the time, like, I ended up accidentally getting sober, my big goal in life had become that I couldn't wait until I turned 18 because then I could work in a bar in little Five Points and make just enough money to live in an apartment with 10 other people and drink the way that I wanted to drink. School was terrible. I went to Towers High School for 6 months when I got here, and then they suggested that I might feel more comfortable at Open Campus. So I went to Open Campus High School, and Open Campus was the kind of place where if you're responsible for your own hours and if you skip class, they don't, like, call your parents, but if you miss more than 3 full days of a class, they just drop you from the class, natural consequences. So what would happen was every single time I would go into every quarter going, this time I'm going to go to class, and every single quarter I would drop all my classes, and I would end up pretending to go to school every day. Bye, Dad. See ya. And I didn't have any classes to go to. So now, at this point, I don't think any of what I'm doing is unmanageable. I do think that school is not stimulating enough, and I do think that there's a lot of reasons for a lot of things that are wrong in my life, and that none of them, of course, have to do with me or my drinking. It really didn't occur to me that I might even be an alcoholic. And I say I kind of got sober accidentally, but I started dating a guy, and I was, like, super in love, and it was super dramatic because that's the only kind of relationship I'm capable of is one that's really dramatic. So after we're dating a while, he ended up getting put in treatment, and this was, you know, 1988. He went to CPC Parkwood, and back then you went to treatment for, like, 30 days. I mean, that's what happened. Like, that doesn't happen quite as much anymore. But he went to treatment, and his parents locked him up, and it was because of some notes that I had been writing with him. And he ends up going to treatment, and I think maybe he needs treatment because clearly he has some problems. And I'll stay sober for him. That's what I said. I said, I will stay sober for him because I was in love and I was going to stay sober for him. And that started the first time that I ever tried to stay sober. Because before that, I never tried to stay sober. I tried to pull things together, but none of that in my head ever involved being sober. But I remember going like, well, I'm going to stay sober and be supportive. And then I realized he was locked up. So a couple days in, I was like, well, if I drink, it's not like he's going to know. So if I just lie and tell him I'm not drinking, then it's still the same as being supportive. So that's how that started. And at the time, you know, it was interesting. I didn't see that as I couldn't stay sober. It's not like I saw that as a relapse. I just saw that as I would change my mind, and it didn't make logical sense anymore. I had control over whether or not I drank, and I would just choose to drink again because why I needed to quit drinking just wasn't as clear to me as it had been previously. So he was in that treatment, and then he got out, and I went to my first AA meeting with him. So that was 1988. I was 17 years old, and we went to the Triangle Club, and it was different than it is now, and it was smoking on one side of the room and not smoking on the other side of the room, and it really didn't matter because the whole thing was like a cloud of smoke, which I thought was awesome because I could sit in there and chain smoke. But we got there, I think, right at 8 o'clock, and we left right at 9. And I don't remember that much about what was said at all. I mean, what I do remember was I didn't think it was a bad place. I thought it was really cute that all of you old people had a place that you could go and sober up. I mean, I really did. I went and it didn't feel like it had anything to do with me, you know, and being 17 years old. Triangle was probably a relatively young place then, too, but not to me. I mean, if you were over 25, you were old. And it just didn't connect. But, you know, and I'm still doing my lying, and he's going into outpatient, my boyfriend, and doing all this other stuff, and I'm still lying, saying, I'm sober for you, I'm staying sober for you. And he kind of had to go to this sort of residential on the other side of town and sobered up there. And anyway, this went on for a while until I think it became clear that I probably wasn't sober. But he didn't know how to, like, say, hey, look, if you don't sober up, I'm probably going to have to break up with you. So what he said was, you know, I'm out of treatment now, but I'm going to be going to a lot of meetings, and I probably won't be able to see you unless you start going to meetings. I won't be able to see you very much. And he said that, and I knew what that meant. And so I think the only way that God was ever going to get me into, you know, any kind of a 12-step program at that point in my life was going to be for a dude. But he was going to these young people's 12-step meetings on the other side of town, and I was like, well, I'll check that out, okay. And I went to, you know, this young people's program meeting, and I walked in, and people there were younger than me, and people there were older than me. And, you know, but, I mean, some, you know, nobody was old, that's for sure. And they were, like, you know, running around and smoking cigarettes and being crazy and all hyped up and having fun, and, you know, and it was like I could hear what they were talking about. Those old people that were in the Triangle Club that weren't really very old, I couldn't hear anything about what they were talking about, and it didn't have to do with me. You know, but, you know, here was a group of kids that I could listen to what they were saying. And some kid who wasn't even sober that long sat down next to me at my first meeting, and he was just, you know, we're kind of chatting, and I'm kind of like, what are you in for, you know? And he was telling me a little bit about his story. And what I remember about listening to his story is going, what the heck is this kid doing here? Like, this kid didn't even drink that much. You know, like, what is, I got loaded more than this kid. And the significance of that at the moment was lost on me. But I could hear what he said. And of course I walked in and lied because I'd been lying to my boyfriend this whole time. So I was like, oh yeah, and I totally already had like 4 months sober and blah, 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 and all this. But I stayed, and I made a commitment to stay. And the other thing was, you know, this whole God thing kind of freaked me out an awful lot. And I was very agnostic. I was very pseudo-intellectual. I very much did not believe in God. And one of my favorite hobbies when I was drinking was arguing with Christians who would argue with me, because that was great fun. And, you know, there was an awful lot of God conversation, you know, that was around the 12 steps and, you know, people talking about God, and every time I would just bristle. And I thought that it was cool to kind of hang out, and I'd found these people and like, all right, let's check this out, but I'm not going to do any of that God stuff, you know. And they told me to get a sponsor, and I was like, oh yeah, sure, that chick, okay, great, and never called her. And I was going to do it my way. And so I was sober for the first few months really by entertainment. I mean, more than anything else. Because, thank God, I mean, they were young people. I mean, I was 17 years old. They went out, they hung out, they did stuff. They, you know, stayed at Denny's until like 3 in the morning, or, I don't, you know, smoking cigarettes. I'm not even sure what all we did, but it was fun. I mean, whatever we did, it was fun. And thank God, because it kept me around long enough to hear just a little bit at a time, you know. And at the time, had I come in and I had some big book thumping person going like, well, you need to sit down and you need to start to read this book and blah, 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 and this is what an alcoholic, I wasn't ready for all that. But what I did have in my life were these younger people who talked to me about what alcoholism was, what the disease of alcoholism was, and what their experience was, in a way that I could hear. And I could begin to sort of intellectually go, you know what? Maybe the alcohol is the problem. It had never occurred to me that it wasn't normal to drink to blackout every single time I drank. It literally never occurred to me that that wasn't normal. It hadn't occurred to me that, like, maybe that was the source of some of the problems in my life. And that's the good thing about, you know, sobering up around young people is, you know, I hear the first step and I'm like, my life's not unmanageable. Like, I got food in the fridge. I have a roof over my head, you know. And I had young people who were around to be like, you know what, the only parts of your life that are manageable are the parts that other people are managing for you. Everything that you are responsible for is completely unmanageable. And I had to think about that. And they were right. You know, I had friendships, burned bridges. You know, I'd already been kicked out of my mom's because of my drinking, and I didn't entirely see it that way. I just saw it as, you know, if she would just let me do what I want, we'd all be okay. But really, that was a direct result of my drinking. You know, I had already lost a job because of my drinking. Like, all of these things that happen, everything that I was responsible for was completely unmanageable. So I had young people around to say things like that to me. And so some of it started to click. And it wasn't enough right away for me to want to do the steps and do things. But like I said, it kept me around long enough to hit a bottom. It kept me here long enough to hit a bottom. And what happened was when I had about 4 months sober, and I actually had time sober, and I did just somewhere during that point, I did cop to being just, by the time I had like 30 actual days, I felt really guilty and I liked you guys a lot. And I finally got honest about the fact that I didn't have, and it's kind of like you guys had all been waiting for me to say that, like, oh my God, like we knew you were full of it. There was nothing that really happened at 4 months exactly, except for that I just had an utter meltdown. I had an utter meltdown and I was sitting in my driveway with my boyfriend in the car and I'm like, and I'm bawling. I'm just bawling and like the kind where I'm rocking back and forth and the only words I know to put on it are I just want to go home. I just want to go home. I just want to go home. I'm sitting in my driveway. I mean, but those were the only words to describe how I felt was I just want to go home. And I hit that point where I'm either going to have to off myself or drink or do the stupid stuff that you people are telling me to do. But I could not stand how uncomfortable my skin felt anymore. That was the point that I was at. And so thankfully I decided that maybe I would try the stupid things that you people were telling me to do. And so that night I called my sponsor, finally. And we got together and we talked and she was like, you know what? It's time to start praying. And I was like, oh God, because I didn't believe in God. And now I kind of wanted what you guys had and I saw that it worked and I saw that your eyes were like, had light in them and all these great things, but I didn't know how to get from where I was to where you were. I didn't know how to go like, okay, now I believe. You know, it just doesn't work like that. And I had all these reasons why I had problems with all these different religions and, you know, and I'm having this just intellectual like, bleh, you know, and my sponsor just goes, quit worrying about what you don't believe in and worry about what you do believe in, even if it's almost nothing. And that was a huge breaking point for me, a huge turning point. It didn't feel like it at all at the time. It still felt stupid at the time. But it was a huge turning point for me because I could start with, okay, I had almost nothing. I just had that there might be something because you guys had something. And so that night I hit my knees for the first time. And I got down on my knees and it felt like nothing. And I said something like, hey, whatever you are, like I need some help, so thanks. And really, like that was it. And nothing amazing happened, you know, like the earth didn't move. And I called my sponsor and I was like, okay, I prayed. And she was like, great, do it again tomorrow. Okay. And I did. And it felt stupid and insignificant. But you know what? That was the turning point where things started to change. And I started to do more things like that. And I started to follow the direction that people gave me to do. And you know what? Slowly but surely, amazingly enough, you know, the things that people said in meetings started to make sense to me. My skin started to fit a little bit at a time. You know, I started to show up and be of service at meetings. And I worked through the steps and I made amends to my parents and God bless my parents. You know, they put up with an awful lot for me. And I started this journey And so, you know, I sobered up. By the time I sobered up, I was almost 18 years old. I was 17, almost 18 years old. And I can tell you that when I got here, I was not expecting to stay. I didn't even think I needed to stay. I didn't think this was my problem, you know. And I remember watching somebody, though. You know, it was funny. I didn't think alcohol was my problem, but I have this very clear memory at my first meeting of watching somebody pick up a 30-day chip and going like, wow, if you could stay sober for 30 days, you could stay sober like forever. Like, that just, you know, that sounded like a really long time to me, you know. And, you know, if I don't pick up a drink between now and May 15th, it's going to be 30 years. I mean, yeah. It hasn't happened yet, so no clap. Still got to make it. But it's, I mean, and it feels surreal. And after a while, you know, what happens is, you know, if you work the steps and you have a higher power, and you don't pick up a drink, you too can get old in this program. So now what's interesting is, you know, I've had a foundation that gave me this amazing life that I continue to use and grow and change, you know. And as long as I grow and change in this program, the steps continue to be absolutely 100% alive for me. You know, I have, in this program, I worked as a counselor for many years in the beginning. I moved around a lot. We were talking a lot about some of my moves tonight. I mean, gosh, I moved from Atlanta. I lived in Texas. I lived in Phoenix. I lived in, you know, Colorado. Came back to Atlanta in, like, 97. And then went through a major bottom and had a huge, like, oh, and I was married and then I was divorced. Oh, I forgot that. That was early on in the beginning. By the way, fear of not knowing what I wanted to do with my life, that's a bad reason to get married. I'm just going to tell you that right now. If you're not sure what you want to do with your life, it's not a good time to get married. And it wasn't tragic or anything like that. But you know what? I went through it, and I got to grow through it, and I got to learn from it. Why? Because, you know, I have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have the 12 steps today. So I moved around a lot, was a counselor for a long time, hit a huge bottom that was a big change in my life where basically it felt... Have you ever prayed for God to remove anything that stands between you and him? I'm just saying, if you're going to do that, just be really careful. Or actually, let me rephrase that. Just be really sure that you mean it. Because there was a point in my life where I was praying that prayer because I really just kind of felt like I felt kind of stuck. And I was praying that prayer for a while for God to remove anything that stood between me and God. And I lost a job and then a boyfriend. I moved. I mean, it was like everything in my life changed in the next couple of years. And it was still today. I look back on it as one of the toughest spiritual challenges that I ever had to walk through. But I'm so grateful for it. I'm so grateful for it because it threw me into some really great people, and it threw me into connection with God that I had never, it was like I had to level up, you know, I had to level up with God. I had to get to a place where there really was nothing between me and God. And I knew that, like, that place, when my head hit the pillow at night between me and God, that was the most important place in the whole world, you know, outside of anything else. And up until that point, I mean, I was sober, I had a relationship with God, but it was like I could still, you know, put some things in there. But that sobriety bottom, it was a huge turning point for me. And that's actually the sobriety bottom that brought me to my current home group, because that was all going on, gosh, in 2001. That was 2001. And it was because, like I said, like, everything changed. So my job changed. I had been doing counseling for a long time. And then I ended up walking into an architectural firm because I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. But I kind of had these administrative skills. So I walked into an architectural firm and somehow got a job there. And I was like, all right, well, this is what I'm going to do until I figure out what I want to do when I grow up. And I had to change home groups because I was, like, on the other side of town, and there was no way I was going to get to where my other home group had been, like, way out in Gwinnett County. And I started walking into 8111, and I had been to 8111, but I didn't really know anybody at 8111. And I walked into the Rule 62 group, and I was in the kind of place where, like, I had like 10-ish something years sober, and, like, I remember being asked if I was a newcomer. You know, I had this one kid, Mario, who I still tease, who, like, sat down next to me at some point, and he was like, so what halfway house are you in? And I was like, that's your line? Really? Come on, man. But I was in that kind of a place where my life felt so disheveled that I looked like a newcomer. I felt like a newcomer. And there was this sweet girl named Candy who just was all love and just took me, gave me a big hug and just was sweet. And she just became my friend. I mean, she was my friend. And Rule 62 just felt like a good place to be. And it was really solid in service. And I tell you that I had been a counselor for a number of years, and to a certain extent, like, that had kind of kept me out of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had a lot of that kind of thing over here, and I had a lot of commitments over here, and I never really felt like I could commit to, like, you know, I would have a home group, but I wouldn't be like GSR, I wouldn't sign up for any of that stuff. I didn't even really learn that much about that kind of stuff. And now with this transition in my life, I was like, I need to really make AA my home in a whole new way that I haven't had to before. And I was like, I really need to learn about, like, the service stuff. And Candy was, like, all up in the service. And she was like, yeah, you totally do. And she was really positive and stuff, too. And so she was like, you can be our secretary. We need a group secretary. And I'm like, all right, great. So I signed up to be a secretary, which isn't a bad job. And that's actually what led me to Macon for the first time, oddly enough. Because there was a point, you know, maybe a year or so in, and the GSR couldn't go, and the alternate GSR couldn't go to the area assembly, and they were like, well, somebody needs to just go and at least take notes, like, even if you can't vote. And I'm like, I'll go. And so I went to the assembly for the first time, and that was that one I was talking about where my head hurt by the end of it, and the treasurer's report. I think Bill might have actually been the treasurer at that time. Might have been. And it didn't make any sense to me. And I was like, I have no idea what all this means. And I'm trying to take some kind of notes to bring back. And, you know, but I kept going back, though. And every other opportunity that I had to go back, because I had great talks with people. I met great people. So kind of like that chick who said it was like, you know, AA concentrate. I must have tapped into that, because I enjoyed the experience. As much as it wore me out, I enjoyed the experience. And I was interested in learning more about it. And then I, you know, reluctantly agreed to become our group's alternate GSR. You know, I made a deal with my friend Pat at the time, I said, okay, if you'll be GSR, I'll be alternate GSR, but I'll go to all the things with you, and we'll learn it all together. And we did. And so we went to Macon. So even when I was alternate GSR, I started going to Macon, like, every single time, and I was going to our zone meetings even when I was alternate GSR. And that was actually really great, because I learned a lot, so I felt like maybe I knew what I was doing by the time I got around to being a GSR. But, I mean, when I dipped my toe in that pool, like, I was like, what does DCM stand for? Like, PIC, what? What do these acronyms mean? I didn't know what any of it meant. And if you've ever been to the assembly and had your head hurt, I can tell you, if you continue to go back, it actually does begin to make sense. God help you, but it does begin to make sense after a while. And service it's just always been really important to me. And so I'm going to fast forward to a couple of interesting things. And, you know, one is that, so I stayed at that architectural firm. I didn't think I was going to stay at that architectural firm, but it was a great place to be. And I ended up having opportunities to learn about all kinds of great stuff. I got into marketing, got into business development, you know, did all these cool things and worked there until I had to take a break for a couple of years during the recession when everything, you know, went to heck in a handbasket. And then came back and worked there some more. And then I don't know how this happens exactly, but, you know, a little over 2 years ago, I had an opportunity. I was going to leave where I was. It was one of those times, like, where, you know, I was working for a firm, and it was time to leave. And it was kind of like, you know, the whole universe was giving me a nudge going, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. And I didn't really know where I wanted to go next. And so I was praying about it, and I was talking about it and going, like, you know what, there will be divine direction. Because at this point I learned there's always divine direction if I'm willing to look for it. You know, and I was talking to one of the other principals there who was like, you know what, it's kind of time for me to go too, and maybe we ought to talk about, you know, starting a company, because I think I'm going to start my own firm. And a little over 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to start a new firm. And I'm not an architect. Let me tell you, I got an opportunity to come on and be a partner in an architectural firm, and I'm not an architect. And I'll tell you another little known secret. I never went to college. I have a GED, and I don't say that to brag, because I don't recommend it. But, you know, but to me, I have this really crazy, awesome life when I'm willing to trust God. And it's interesting. I shouldn't be where I am today. And who I was when I got here and who I am now, like, I shouldn't be where I am today. And the only reason I think I'm there is because I'm willing to show up and I'm willing to do the next right thing, and I ask God for divine direction, and I'm willing to follow it. And I'm willing to work really hard, you know. I'm willing to show up and do the work. And I swear, most everything that I ever learned about business, I learned in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was kind of where I was going when I was talking about service, because you know what? There's a lot of people in the business world, I'll tell you right now, have no idea how to run a meeting. I learned how to run a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned about primary purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned about the traditions. I learned about, like, show up and do your work and, like, go the extra mile. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned about structure. I learned about, you know, just how to, like, you know, get some stuff done, really, how to organize. I spent time on committees organizing things. You know, I learned a lot about how the world works being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I 100% believe that there is no way in my career that I would be where I am right now if it wasn't for what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. So what an opportunity to have a great training ground, you know? And I think that's exactly what service was. So I had the opportunity to be alternate GSR and GSR, and I've served on some committees. And then I really had the honor of serving as the area secretary. You know, somebody recognized me tonight and was like, oh, you were the secretary. I was like, I was. I got to do that. That was like in 2008, not long after I got married. I stood for area secretary, which, by the way, is one of the funnest jobs, I think, in all of, you know, the state. So it's being the secretary for the state. And that was a great place to learn about how AA works and to watch the traditions come alive, you know. I mean, it really, really was. And I got to serve with some really amazing, beautiful people who I love, love dearly. That's what I get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and the other thing that happens when I trust God is, you know, I told you about how I got married that first time, and it was totally out of fear, which is never a good reason to get married. So I had been divorced, and then I was single, you know, for a while, and learning the lessons that single people learn, like how to enjoy being alone and liking myself and, you know, that kind of stuff, and had a date and go, ooh, not that. And be entirely honest and be sponsored, you know, through that whole process, and, you know, had a Brady Bunch date. You know, I call it Brady Bunch dating, you know, where you show up and there's not any expectations. You actually just learn how to enjoy being with somebody else, like how to, like, just have fun and be on a date, and, like, you're not going to hook up that night. You're just going to have fun and get to know each other. What a crazy concept that was. Because when I was getting loaded, I mean, I had a boyfriend if you just wanted to hang out still the next day. I mean, that was my idea of dating. So anyway, so I went through this whole learning curve, and my husband is sitting here on the front row, and I got to tell you, tonight is our 11-year wedding anniversary. And he's here with me tonight in this romantic setting. I met Paul. Paul and I, remember I talked about going to Open Campus High School? Paul and I both went to Open Campus High School at the same time, and we did not know each other, and we never met. And the reason why, it was Paul's first year sober, and it was my last year drinking. He actually went to class. He actually showed up early, and he went to class, and apparently we traveled in different circles that year. We never met. And what else I think is interesting is, so we both sobered up, and we both sobered up kind of around different groups of young people, but with some overlap. And we never met. We never met during those first few years. We went to some of the same places. We can recall some of the same things, but never met. And I didn't meet Paul until, you know, I'd moved back to Atlanta and been here really for quite a while. I think it was 2005. So we both had been around a while. And I like to think that, you know, I met Paul exactly when I was supposed to. And I had an awful lot of growing and change. God had a lot of work to do with all of this. Before I was ready for Paul. And, you know, I know a little bit about Paul's story, and I won't share for him, but I'm pretty sure that God had an awful lot of work to do with him before he was ready for all of this. Because this is a lot. I'm just saying. And I think it's all in divine timing, you know. And marriage is one of those things where it's interesting. It's a lot of work sometimes. I got a lot of defects, I got to tell you. I may have been around for almost 30 years, but I still have defects. I still have a sponsor. We still work on these defects, you know, and I still have to look to God all the time to help me one day at a time to be the kind of wife that God would have me be. Not necessarily that Paul would have me be, but to be the kind of wife that Paul would have me be, or that God would have me be. Oh, my God, I said it wrong. Oh, she's so excited right now. You know, and that's what I get to wake up and do today is go, okay, between me and God, and I sit and I do my morning meditation. And my morning meditation somehow waffles, you know, between some kind of formal meditation and sitting and staring with a cup of coffee with my dogs. But what that time is for me is like, okay, between me and God, like, what does being a good wife look like today? You know, what is being a good employer? I'm an employer. What does being a good employer look like today? You know, what do I need to show up and do today? You know, between me and God, what's the kind of sponsor that I need to be, the kind of friend that I need to be? And that gets to be my focus today. And that doesn't mean I do it perfectly all the time, but you know what? I wake up, I ask that question, and I keep asking that question every day, and I keep trying to live that better every day. And you know what? When I do that, life is an amazing adventure. I could not have told you how my life was going to end up. I definitely couldn't have told you that I was going to be a partner in an architectural firm. Like, how weird is that? But it's amazing, and it's so much fun. You know, I get to help create and do some cool stuff, and it's great. And I wouldn't have scripted it, you know. I was scripting. I couldn't wait until I turned 18 years old so that I could work in a bar in Little Five Points and make enough money to live in an apartment with 10 other people. That was my script, right? So I like the adventure, and I know I'm not done. As long as you know, I continue to seek God's will, I ain't done. And I love that about this program. So thank you guys for having me here tonight. I really appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the weekend. Thank you.